Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Jordan Sava.
In this episode, we are joined by Michelle Blackwood, breast cancer surgeon, chief of breast surgery at Robert Wood Johnson Barnabas Health and Rutgers, as she discusses the current landscape of breast cancer treatment. Thank you so much for joining us. To start, how is personalized medicine changing the field?
Right now.
So breast cancer treatment has changed dramatically in the past, I would say 10 to 15 years, but a lot of changes are occurring very quickly right now on the landscape. So the changes occur in four different areas. One is breast surgery. Two is systemic treatment, meaning chemotherapies or anti-estrogen pills or treatments. The third thing is in breast imaging and breast screening. And the fourth thing is in radiation oncology. So it's a big question and with a lot of different answers to it. One of it, and I'll just try and address them as succinctly as I can. Everything is essentially personalized to the patient and to their physical status and to the cancer itself. So the first thing is breast surgery has come a long way as far as restoring women to the way they look and feel about themselves. So breast cancer surgery comes in multiple options, one of which is a mastectomy, one of which is a lumpectomy. Those are the two basics, where you take the cancer out of the surrounding tissue, which is a lumpectomy, or a mastectomy, where you take all the breast tissue out. In those realms, however, there's a lot of different options. One is that we many times can do a lumpectomy and we do a breast lift on both breasts at the same time, or reshape the breast, or a reduction. And many women feel very comfortable and are very happy with this choice. The second option is for mastectomies. It used to be that we took off all the breast tissue, a lot of the skin, sometimes the muscles, a lot of lymph nodes. That essentially is not what we do anymore. Many times we're able to do what looks like nipple sparing mastectomies, where the breast looks and feels like the breast when it's done. We restore sensation with a nerve graft. We take the breast tissue out and essentially leave the entire skin and or nipple and areolar complex so that a woman looks and feels like herself when she wakes up. Those are big picture items, and they really have to do with the patient, the type of cancer they have, what they look like, their overall health. There's also a number of women, if they do a mastectomy, that are choosing what their term is to go flat, which means no reconstruction. This is something we used to do in the 1980s and 90s, and then we morphed into offering reconstruction at the same time as we do a mastectomy. So the pendulum is swinging a little bit the other way. And some women choose it because of their overall health. Some women choose it just for personal preference. Some of them don't want other operations that have to be, are essentially cosmetic later on to kind of shape the breast tissue. So there's a lot of options for patients out there, which is nice because then patients can choose what they feel comfortable with. The problem with that is there are a lot of options out there. So it's a double-edged sword because sometimes patients come in. I had a patient come in to see me last week. She has a lot of options about how to be treated. And she, quite frankly, doesn't particularly know how to make a decision. She says that making decisions is very difficult for her anyway. So this makes it even doubly hard. So as far as chemotherapy and systemic treatments, so everybody who has invasive cancer gets some form of treatment either before or after surgery. That can be chemotherapy, the dreaded word chemotherapy. But chemotherapies are very targeted now to the type of cancer that the patient has. And there are many treatments actually that we give the chemotherapy prior to surgery to either shrink the tumor down or to eliminate the tumor in the breast prior to surgery. I tell patients who have stage 3 or 4 breast cancer, it's kind of like you wouldn't renovate a house that's on fire. So first you put out the fire, then you renovate afterwards. So that does give a lot more options to patients, and they can do their surgery after their treatment systemic treatment. So we get rid of the cancer cells in the breast and we get rid of the cancer cells in the body. The other thing is that after a woman has her surgery, she is going to, if she hasn't received chemotherapy, she is going to get something afterwards. So if there's four basic types of breast cancer, estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, estrogen receptor positive and progesterone receptor positive breast cancer, HER2 new amplified breast cancer, which is about 18% of breast cancers. And then there's the dreaded triple negative. These four different breast cancers are treated very differently. Some are treated with pills, some are treated with injections, some are treated with a year-long treatment, some of them are treated with just 3 to 4 months of treatment, some are treated with 5 to 10 years worth of treatment. So it's a lot to go over here, but when patient meets with their breast cancer surgeon, the breast cancer surgeon acts really as the quarterback, informing them, trying to show them all the different options that are available to them, and then guiding them to probably what we think is the best treatment for them. As far as breast imaging and screening, we've had some interesting dialogues about screening and imaging because we now are really understanding a lot more about women's risk of breast cancer. So if a woman is a high risk of breast cancer, that means she might get screened as early as 20, 25 years old, depending on her gene mutations, her family history, other biopsies. We are seeing breast cancers earlier and earlier than we used to see them. The rates of breast cancer in the under 40 crowd is increasing and has been for 10 years. So this, some patients want to blame COVID. They want to blame other treatments. They want to blame you know, the vaccine. It's not from that. This predates that. This trend was occurring earlier. It's happening actually across the board, as many people have understood from the famous people that have gotten breast cancer recently. You know, Olivia Munn is in her early 40s and just an actress. She just had breast cancer, but in both breasts. But part of it was that she got what's called MRI screening. Due to her family history, she went ahead and had MRIs. MRIs are different than mammograms. MRIs are actually performed with a contrast IV that's given intravenously at the time of the MRI. Most breast MRIs are done with both breasts being done at the same time. The woman lies face down in the MRI machine, and then many times the head and shoulders can be somewhat out. So even some of my patients who are claustrophobic can do this. The other thing is there's no compression of the breast. So the women who dread that mammogram compressing your breast, some of them say to me, I just want to do MRIs in the future. Right? Unfortunately, that's not an option because mammograms can pick up precancers that we might not see on MRI. MRIs are a very good tool for high-risk patients, for patients who've had breast cancer in the past, for patients who have a family history or a gene mutation that causes breast cancer. And those patients really need to be guided by a breast surgical group that has a high-risk clinic like we have. Patients come to see us who don't have breast cancer. And every year we get their imaging and we do their breast exams. And we also talk about prevention. So it's a triad of care that really does help women either prevent breast cancer or treat breast cancer at a very early stage, which is, of course, one of the things we want to do. Now, the fourth thing is radiation oncology. Radiation is very poorly understood by a lot of people. Radiation is hard to describe to patients. I try and describe it as a beam of light across their breast. And it comes in a lot of different varieties. It used to be that it was 6 weeks worth of treatment for one breast, and the patients laid down on the table and had to have it Monday through Friday for 6 weeks. I was just discussing this with my aunt this weekend, who 20 years ago had breast cancer, and talked about her radiation therapy and after her lumpectomy. And I said to her, well, guess what? A lot of times we don't do that now in postmenopausal women. We can do 3 weeks worth of treatment. We can do 5 days for some women. Sometimes we can forego radiation. So radiation is not chemotherapy. It's not your hair falling out. It's not an IV. It's very well tolerated, even by some of my more elderly patients. And what it does is it reduces the risk of recurrence. So that obviously helps with treatment and cure. So not one size fits all anymore for radiation therapy as well. So we're very lucky that this field of mine that I have enjoyed being a part of for a number of years has so many options for patients. And we really love being able to tailor it to the patient and tailor it to her breast cancer and tailor it to her health. Just a few minutes ago, I was talking to a plastic surgeon about a patient who wants a mastectomy, but she has a lot of health issues. She's had cardiac surgery, she's had abdominal surgery, she has diabetes that's out of control, she has obesity that needs addressing, she has hypertension that needs control. And what patients need to understand is we can't just come in and do the surgery and you're cured sometimes. We have to work on the whole patient. So before that patient gets to the operating room, we need to address her medical problems as well, because it's not just me doing the surgery and taking the breast cancer out. It's trying to make the patient healthier overall to make sure that she can understand that it's not just one size fits all, and it's not just I cut the cancer out, you're done. It doesn't work like that. We really need to address her diabetes, her obesity, her heart disease, and her other surgeries that she's had, because that may impact how, if we do a mastectomy, how we reconstruct it. So now I'm going back to the patient and we're going to talk about, and she does need chemotherapy, and it also impacts the chemotherapy that she has. So when a patient comes for cancer treatment, not just breast cancer treatment, but cancer treatment in general, we really need to address her health overall and make her healthier. I just recently saw a patient I operated on about 3 years ago during the pandemic. At the time, she had been about 80 pounds overweight. She had prediabetes, she had hypertension, and now she's lost 80 pounds. She's cancer-free. She is lifting weights. She's working on her diet, and her exercise and all of that. And I said to her, you do realize you are healthier now than when you first came to see me with breast cancer 3 years ago. And she totally admitted it. She feels great. And now we as the breast surgeons and the breast cancer treatment doctors have intervened at a time in her life when we will hopefully cure her of breast cancer, but also make her healthier overall.
That was a really wonderful answer. Thank you so much for all of that and sharing those stories. Off of that, how does genomic profiling fit into the overall strategy for personalizing breast cancer care?
So genomic profiling of breast cancers is, again, poorly understood, I think, sometimes by patients. Genomic profiling means that we look at the cancer itself, sometimes right after the biopsy. We take the tumor and we do a deep dive into the actual genes that cause that cancer to grow and to proliferate, and also to give it its signature, if you will. So genomic profiling really took off about 20 years ago, especially for estrogen receptor positive breast cancers. And what we found is that many women may not need chemotherapy that we thought previously did need chemotherapy. It's not about particularly just the size of the tumor and the stage of the tumor and the cancer, but it's about how the tumor behaves. So if we do the genomic profiling of the tumor, and there are different ones out there, there's MammaPrint, there's Oncotype, there's a lot of buzzwords in different companies. Patients really like the idea that it predicts and can be prognostic and tell us how that tumor will behave and whether the patient would actually benefit from chemotherapy versus just benefiting from having an anti-cancer or anti-estrogen pill. It's really changed the way we drill down towards the patient and their tumor. The genomic profiling is increasing, however. It's not just about hormone positive breast cancers anymore. We're actually looking at the genomic profiling of many more tumors, whether they're triple negative or whether they're caused by other genes. And there are companies now that we can send these tumors to that can actually look closely at these cancers and tell us, hey, this cancer is more aggressive than we thought, or it's being driven by this gene mutation. Do me a favor, take this treatment, not that treatment. We also do genetic profiling of the patients now. The American Society of Breast Surgeons, a number of years ago, came out with the recommendation that anyone with breast cancer consider getting gene testing done. Gene testing is done either on the patient's saliva or their blood, and it looks at, do they have a gene that caused the breast cancer? The very famous ones that people know about are BRCA1 and 2, but there's many other gene mutations and gene mutations that can cause different cancers in the family and in the patient. There's some that can cause uterine cancer, some that can cause ovarian cancer, some that can cause GI cancers or colon cancers. So it's really important for the patient to be tested for this and to consider it for her extended family. It also can be helpful for patients, particularly if they're young, because they want to know what other cancers can we prevent by making sure that if they have a gene mutation, we can be on the lookout and screen for those other cancers earlier than we would normally.
Perfect. And kind of off of what you were just saying, are there any specific subtypes of breast cancer where genomic profiling is particularly valuable in guiding treatment decisions?
That is a loaded question. So, yes and no. I do think, I shouldn't speak for others, but I do think this is the future of cancer care in general. So, genomic profiling of tumors really took off, as I said, started in the 20 years ago and then has evolved. There are some companies now that actually follow patients for recurrences in their bloodstream. Some of this is very experimental. Some of this is very new. And basically, when the patient's multiple years out from their cancer treatment, you take a blood sample and you check for essentially DNA in their bloodstream to see if they have any cancer cells floating in there. I do believe this is going to be the future. The problem with genomic profiling tumors is it kind of got ahead of the treatments. So what I mean by that is we found gene mutations and we can pinpoint a lot of gene mutations, but we may not have the actual drug or treatment that goes with it. The other part is we have also seen gene mutations that occur in the tumor and the medicines that should fight against it didn't work. So the question is, why is that? And the reality is that many cancers, I believe, are not just driven by one gene or two genes. Sometimes they're driven by multiple genes, and there's probably some sort of interaction between these genes. Some genes turn the cancer on, some turn the cancer off, some work in conjunction with other genes, probably to turn them on or turn them off. So this is a really exciting future for cancer treatment and breast cancer treatment, particularly. And I think there's a lot more to come on that. I think one of the things that people should know is that not all of this is ready for prime time treatment or current treatments, but it's getting there. We also were looking at some point, you might have heard of drugs like Keytruda, that have been used for multiple different cancers, right? Lung cancers. Now we had looked at cancers, breast cancers, and to see if they expressed this gene called PD-L1. So at the beginning, we found that if you express PD-L1, Keytruda, or it comes by other names, pembrolizumab, et cetera, could fight against these cancers. Well, in reality, there are probably breast cancers that can be, now we're finding out, that can be cured or help cured by these same drugs, even if the cancer doesn't express PD-L1. So the question is, why is that? There's many theories about it, and there's some exciting work being done on it, But sometimes the testing gets ahead of the treatments, and sometimes the treatments get ahead of the testing. So it's very exciting, and I don't mean to be vague about it, but these are the realities of cancer treatment. Many treatments that we give after we do the surgery are considered quote unquote preventive chemotherapy or preventive estrogen receptor pills. You might have heard about this with Kate Middleton. She had cancer cells found in whatever surgery that she had after her surgery was performed, which can happen. And now she's getting what's called preventive chemotherapy. And what that means is that we give treatments based on the fact that we know that if we don't give it, there's a certain amount of people that will recur for cancer. We do tend to give her or him anti-estrogen pills at least for 5 years, sometimes as long as 10 years. The reason for that is it's like if you have strep throat and say you have an abscess in the back of your throat. The doctor may open it and the pus comes out, but you still need the antibiotics afterwards in case there's a little piece of bacterial cell or something floating in your bloodstream. You don't want that to go to your heart or other parts of your body and cause another infection. Same thing with cancer cells. We know if you have cancer somewhere in your body, particularly, obviously, I work on breast cancer patients, that that cancer cell could be in your bloodstream. We may not be able to measure it right now, but we want to make sure that that cancer cell doesn't land in your liver, your lung, your brain, your bones, and take up residence there. So that's why we give these other treatments on top of the surgery.
That makes perfect sense. Thank you very much for that. And extending off of that question, how do you envision the role of genomic profiling evolving in the future?
I think we are on the precipice of this. I think there's a lot more work that has to be done. We're finding more and more genes. We're finding new medicines that can work in the cancer cell, or they can work in conjunction with the treatment that we already have. You may have heard of CDK4/6 inhibitors. Those drugs can work in conjunction with the anti-estrogen drugs and make those anti-estrogen drugs work better. So we will be drilling down, I think, more and more on cancer cells to find out what makes that cancer cell tick, what makes that cancer cell grow, why does it proliferate? And those genes, I think, are going to be some of the things that we'll be focusing a lot of research on.
Wonderful. And what are some best practices that you would recommend for oncologists wanting to integrate genomic testing into the care for their patients?
So I'm a surgical oncologist, there's medical oncologists, and there's radiation oncologists. Medical oncologists are the ones that choose or work with the team to figure out what's the best systemic treatment, either IV or by mouth, or even injections of drugs. Many oncologists obviously already use genomic profiling of tumors and have for 20 years, right? Because I told you about Oncotype or MammaPrint. These are gene signatures that tell us how these tumors behave. So I would say that medical oncologists with the team, and at least in breast cancer, they work with us all the time in a multidisciplinary way, meaning that we'll have breast conference and we all look at the patient's tumor. We look at the slides, we look at the images, and then we talk about which gene testing to get. Is it necessary? Will you be giving chemotherapy no matter what that gene testing says? So there's an art to medicine. And the beauty of genomic profiling is it's another piece of information for us to make those decisions about. So it's not just about the genomic profiling. And that's probably one of the most important things that medical oncologists and surgical oncologists deal with is to know when to get that test and how to interpret that test. The other thing is, there are some studies looking at patients and drawing their blood in the future to look for recurrences. Again, there are multiple companies looking at this and multiple universities looking at this. I think that medical oncologists, like myself, there's so much change in our field. We'll be keeping up with this on a regular basis. And I think that medical oncologists know that we have to work within the context of all of these tests. You can't just make it based on PD-L1 positivity or an oncotype that said this. If it's a 27-year-old with breast cancer, you may not even use the oncotype. So there's more to come on this. And I think for screening and recurrence screening in the future, I think this is definitely going to be part of what we do, meaning we, the surgeons or the medical oncologists, when we follow these patients in the future.
Definitely. And then are there any challenges in integrating genomic profiling into routine clinical practice? And if so, just what are some things that need to be addressed moving forward?
So, yes, there are a lot of challenges when it comes to genomic profiling. That's a short answer. Genomic profiling is part of the answer. I think the reality is it's not all of the answer. I think that going forward, we need to be really well informed on patients' risk for cancer. Sometimes I'll meet a patient who's had 9 biopsies and now over the years and dense mammogram and a family history of breast cancer, and now she has breast cancer. Had I met her 10 years earlier, maybe we could have really prevented the cancer or talked about her true stratification or true risk. So when it comes to assessing a patient's risk, particularly someone who has checks all the boxes when it comes to risk factors, we really need to be aware of that. I think we're so caught up in treating breast cancer that sometimes we forget there are a lot of people out there that we need to at least inform about the risk of breast cancer.